Take me where the promises are real.
My name is Julie, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NAVA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too, I must have this thing. I have the pleasure of introducing our speaker tonight. I do not know Lily, but I look forward to getting to know her, and I already think she's superhuman because her home group meets at 6:15 in the morning, and I'm never awake at 6:15 in the morning, so I'm impressed that she's still awake now. So I give you Lily. Hey, you guys, I'm Lily. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey.
Something that I normally do before I start my story is read something out of the Big Book. And I'm going to read something that seemed like the most, impossible promise when I first read it. And this is from Working with Others, Chapter 7. It says, frequent contact with newcomers and each other is a bright spot of our lives. Okay, so that wasn't always the case for me. So I'm a little bit nervous. I didn't think I was when I got up here. So anyways, I'm not going to stay too long on my drunkalogue, okay? We all have stories. We all came from something. I am a Georgia native, Marietta born, bred, raised, all that good stuff. I'm the product of a spring break oops. So I have parents that were like 16 and 17 when they had me, forced to get married, you know that thing. And so here I am. I'm really short. So anyway, so we got our, we had some things stacked against us from the very start. I was named after my father, who is named Michael. So I also had another good start. So my name is Michael Lee. All right. And I grew up in before I say where I grew up, my father was murdered when I was about three. So my mother had these two little kids as a teenager, high school dropout, you know, just that was our situation. And she did the best she could do. But we grew up in a pretty poor neighborhood outside the Marietta Square. And there's about three white people there. And I was like one of the three. My brother was like the second of the three. So I was like the little blonde head, blue eyed girl from the, you know, black neighborhood that had a boy's name. So I was like not cool from the rip, okay? I had this chronic desire to be cool, and I didn't know that until I came to AA. But, you know, any and everything that I could do to fit in, whether it was positive or negative or anything in between, I would do. I was so desperately wanting anybody to like me. I hated myself. I also didn't know that until I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. So, you know, fast forward a little bit, you know, I went to school, you know, did the whole thing that kids do. I was a pretty good kid. I wasn't a drinker and didn't get fool around with drugs or anything like that too much. You know, I remember the first time I ever took a sip of alcohol was in the seventh grade. And we, like, there was like five of us. We went and got like the little four pack of like, I don't know, wine coolers. You know, like the hard stuff when you're like, you know, 11, right? So that was my first experience with drinking. I absolutely loved it. I absolutely don't remember much about it. I did black out my very first drunk, and it was awesome, and it sucked, and I swore I was never going to drink again because I did have a hangover from four wine coolers. And I didn't know what a hangover was. I just knew that I felt really, really, really bad, but I felt really, really good the night before. And so it wasn't anything that, you know, I obsessed about early on. I do know that I had fun. There was these things that people were telling me that I did, and everybody was laughing, you know. So I thought that made me cool because they thought I was doing cool things. You know, I didn't really, you know, I was kind of like, I guess, a binge drinker then, you know. I would swear it off for 6 months and drink, you know, get drunk. Sucks. Don't want to drink again. That happened all through middle school. And then in high school, I met a boy. He was from Atlanta, right? That was, like, really cool, you know, in Marietta, to be from Atlanta. And, you know, he was, like, super cool because he was, like, a new kid on the block. And he was tall, dark, and handsome. And he kind of, like, he liked me, you know. And this is the first time I, you know, could get cool. So, you know, I started dating this guy. In my freshman year of high school, I got pregnant. And so here I am doing the same thing my mother did, you know. My husband, well, he wasn't my husband. I never married him. But he didn't get murdered. He just went to prison. So here I am, a high school. I didn't drop out, but I was a high school kid with a child. And nobody helped me, you know, with the child. I was given an ultimatum at 14 to either have an abortion or to leave the home. I now know, you know, that was to try to protect me. You know, at the time, it started my first real big resentment. And it also gave me some power because she couldn't make me. You know, that was important. Like, she couldn't make me. So anyways, I get sent to a maternity home. And, you know, it was probably a good thing. So I stayed in school, no drugs, no drinking. You know, I'm a good kid. I'm going to beat the statistics, right? That, you know, I'm not going to be like this high school dropout, nothing like my mother, right? So, you know, a couple years later, I meet a guy drunk. I'm in a senior in high school. And here I am pregnant with twins. So my family at this time is like, yeah, you might want to think about your kids. You might want to, like, marry this guy. You just might want to, you know. I grew up in the 70s and 80s, so it's just still something that you just didn't have kids unless you were married. So when we get married, I was 17, he was 30. So that's how that went. Don't you laugh. So anyways, fast forward, you know, the second I did have my twins in my senior year of high school. Still not really a drunk, you know, drank a couple of times here and there. Get married, you know, the important thing in my life at the time was signing my own report card. Just to let you know how mature I was with these three kids, right? So, I finished high school. So then I'm grown now and I moved to Detroit. Of all places in the world to move to from Georgia, Detroit is where I ended up with my husband. And we had our fourth child. And my child was killed in a car accident at 3.5 weeks old. And so that's when I discovered how powerful alcohol could be. I went, and it was not wine coolers. It was the hard stuff, and that was a daily thing. I was crazy, to be honest with you. I was super crazy. And, you know, the drinking really, really, really got bad at that point in time. The bad thing for me was that everybody gave me an out. Because everybody understood, oh, she's just going through a hard time. You know, she'll be fine. Who wouldn't drink through this? Well, as long as I had a pass, you know, I went, you know, I don't know if it's nice enough, but I went balls to the walls with her. Okay, excuse me if that's a bad word. But, you know, I went full on, you know, and I really got, I don't know, a bottle of Absolut every single night. But you know what the thing about it was is I cried all the time. It didn't stop the pain. It didn't take it away. And I drank more. And you know, the only thing that happened is really is I secluded. Like my other three kids didn't matter. My husband didn't matter. Nothing mattered except for this big hole that I had. And ironically, he was killed by a drunk driver. So now I'm this like crazy mom that's getting in, you know, mothers against drunk driving, showing up drunk. But everybody understood, you know. And so, you know, that's where we were with that. There was, you know, I super, super, super appreciate single as a purpose. But sometimes when we're drunk, we make stupid decisions. and a drunken spell of I am the victim. I tried some harder stuff, and it really numbed the pain. And so alcohol and drugs are my story. And so I'm not going to stay a whole long time on all this drug stuff. We've all drank till we're crazy, this, that, the other. I'm going to fast forward to about March 3rd, 2004. This is a point in my life I had been, I'm not even looking at my timeline. I'm obsessed with the clock there. So I had been intervened in 1998. By this time, it had been, you know, many, many years. I've moved back to Georgia. I am just crazy. And so there was an intervention on me, like, way before intervention was cool and on TV. And I really thought that I had walked into an ambush. And I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I didn't think I was a drug addict. I didn't think I was doing anything wrong. And if you had my messed up life, you would completely understand why I was drinking, and you'd let me, and you'd leave me alone. And you know, something stopped working. I'm not sure exactly where it was, but I ended up going to jail and stuff like that, doing stupid stuff, right? So the intervention landed me at it was pretty much, okay, I'll go, just shut up, I'll go. And all they wanted me to do was go to AA. It wasn't like this big, you know, Malibu place in California. It was just, can you go to AA meeting? Well, to me, that sounded like punishment for messing up drinking, you know. I didn't want to go to AA, and I didn't want to stop drinking, but I wanted my family to shut up. So I went. And I went to this place, Marietta, I think, or Smyrna, called Rebo's. And Rebo's was awesome. You had to kind of part through the smoke to get in there. And there was a speaker meeting on Saturday night. And I don't know who this guy is to this day, but he told my story. And I honestly didn't know how to know him, because it was even streets of cities that I'd been to, except for this guy had like 20-something years sober. That's probably why I didn't know him. But I remember identifying with someone immediately in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, that was all nice, and oh, yeah, the meeting was fine. So my first meeting was a speaker meeting, and I was invited to go back. Oh, and I won this big book, 1998, at my first AA meeting. And I don't think I opened it for another 4 or 5 years, but I won it. So they invited me back, and that's something that hadn't happened in a very long time. And so the same guy that was chairing, his name was Bill. That's all I remember. And he said, you know, tomorrow's a spiritual meeting, you know, on Sunday morning. So, okay, it sounds like church. Decided to go, and I remember the same guy said, man, isn't this great? We can talk about God, smoke cigarettes, and cuss all at the same time. And I thought, wow, I have found my place. You know, I thought that was great. Beach Church. So, you know, that was my second meeting. And I heard some, you know, God scared me back then. Okay, I wasn't real sure about your, you know, God. But you know, people were nice. So, you know, I kind of enjoyed it. And then my third meeting was a big book study. And so I go back to Rebo's. I think it was Tuesday. And I sit next to this guy at tables like that. You know, I sit next to this guy, Bill, because he's the only guy I remember. And he opens his book up, and it looks kind of like this. And I couldn't believe he had a highlighter out. And so I asked him, I said, Bill, what in the heck could you be highlighting after 20 years? And he says, oh, it's like the Bible. Every time you read it, something pops out. Well, I never had that happen with the Bible, so I just took his word for it. And I asked him, I said, so are you Bill Wilson? Yeah, that's what the whole table did. I started laughing. And so I didn't realize how cute that was, because I was still embarrassed. And so I never went back. I thought they were laughing at me. I know, that's just how big my ego was back then. So it really wasn't that. I did not want to stop drinking. I did not want to stop drinking. So you know what? They made fun of me. They treated me bad. I hate AA. So I'm going to go ahead and fast forward to 1999, my first time to the penitentiary. because, you know, I quit going to Rebo's. I'm just saying. I wasn't interested in 12 steps. You know, y'all had a nice little spiritual meeting, and speaker meetings are fine. I'm not doing any work. So, not doing work and not caring about all that landed me in prison for the first time. And I say first time because my story is a prison story. That's where I ended up four times in the next 6 years. Four times in the 6 years. You know, so I remember the last time I went to prison, it was my moment of clarity. And this was March 3rd, 2004. I knew I was done. I knew I was done. I didn't know how to carry that out. I knew I was locked up in a hotel for a week. Delk and Franklin, somewhere over there. I was on the run from a parole officer. You know, had a warrant out for my arrest. My significant other had died in a car accident, drinking and driving. She wasn't even an alcoholic. That was crazy. I was just crazy. And I picked up the phone, and I called my parole officer, and I asked him to please come get me from that hotel. And I remember him saying, "Miss, you know, I can send you back to prison for that." You know, I said, "I do know that. I can't call my mom. I can't call my family. I have no idea who to call. And if you don't come get me, I'm going to die." I knew that. I couldn't stop crying. Drinking and drugging, I could not stop crying. I knew the gig was up, you know. So he came in and got me. And I remember telling him if he wasn't there in 30 minutes, I was going to hit those streets. I knew that. Please come. And so anyway, he was there in like 29.5 minutes. I was, I'm just saying, that was the worst drunk ever, okay? I knew they were coming to get me. So I got to tell you, they took me to the Cobb County Jail and gave me 30 days to find a program. You know, and this was when my recovery started. I didn't even know it. I was working with a lady priest in there. I think she was a priest, like little collar thing, chaplain lady. And she was giving me some good suggestions. This is somebody that has never read the big book, okay? And I was pretty scared because I also have escape charge on one of those four times to prison. And so a lot of places in Marietta didn't want to take me because I was a flight risk. Mother's Making a Change, it was kind of like the Mary Hall of Cobb County. It takes everybody. They wouldn't take me. They wouldn't take me. Don't you laugh. So anyways, I was getting nervous, you know, week after week. So I remember this priest lady told me, she said, "Why don't you go 3 minutes a day, three times a day, and just thank God?" I said, "I ain't got that much to be thankful for." Hey, she said, "Do one thing for 3 minutes then. Thank him for 3 minutes." And I'm mad about it. I've got... Thank you, God, for my kid's life, and thank you for the kid's life, and thank you for my kid's life. And, I mean, I had nothing, but I did what she said. I was desperate enough. I didn't know I was desperate at the time, but I was desperate enough to do whatever she told me to do, and she told me to help. So I did, and I remember about 3 days into that, you know, Cobb County Jail has these, like, windows that are painted over, so, you know, boys and girls don't look at each other. So there was this little piece of paint chipped off, and I remember putting my eyeball up to it, and I could see the whole world, and I saw these two little birdies do, I don't know if they were playing or fighting or whatever. I was like, "Oh, thank you, God," and it dawned on me it wasn't part of my 3 minutes. I was like, "Oh my God, she tricked me." So I couldn't wait to go tell a lady that it worked so I could start praying for me, you know. I knew that was coming. So, you know, I go back to talk to her next week. Still haven't found a place to go. And one of my sons was in DFACS. I have six sons, by the way, y'all. I left a big part of my life out. I have six adult sons right now. And I tell you, I don't know, dude. So anyways, I wanted that boy to come home, and I wanted to find rehab. And that was the only two things I really could think of to pray for myself. And I remember that lady told me to make a list of everything I wanted to pray for. And those are only two things I could write. I want to find me a treatment center, and I want my middle son to come home with his brothers. You know, I'd forgotten to go get him from school before I called my parole officer. And so that's how that ended up. He went defects because of that. So make a long story short, you know, the lady said, well, everything you want on that list, God pray for the person you hate the most to get it. And I said, I can't do that because I'm going to go to hell because God's going to think I'm lying. He's going to know I'm lying. And she said, do it anyway. You know? And so I did. And so there was, interestingly enough, there's a lady that was in Cobb County jail with me named Lily. And I knew her from the streets. And she stole my car. And I was living a lifestyle where you couldn't really call the police. So she just got my car. So you're it. You're the one I choose to hate the most. And I pray for that girl. Please let Lily's kids go home. And please let Lily find treatment. And please let Lily's life be all better. Blah, blah, blah. You know? And it's funny, I was on the phone with my mom. We're about 3 weeks into my 30 days to find rehab. And I'm talking with my mother, and I'm upset. Another place has denied me that she's still going to court, catching it with the courts with my son. And I'm frustrated. And of all people, Lily came up to me and gave me a number. She said, call this number. And it was a number to Bridge to Hope. And Bridge to Hope accepted me. And I got to tell you, it was one of those moments where maybe, just maybe, somebody else knows something more than I do. But see, I knew it all. I'm just telling you. I knew it all. That didn't work out. So here we are. Make it Bridge to Hope. Okay. Oh, I left out a big part. In the process of waiting for rehab, I had a little baby in jail. Yeah, I had a daughter in jail. I didn't get to bond with her. I didn't get to, you know, hold her. I didn't get to take her home. She was very, very, very premature. She was my only daughter. And so anyways, I go to Bridge to Hope. My daughter dies. And so I'm like, F y'all and your God. That's where I was with that. Here we go again, you know. The difference is that I got the grieving counseling at Bridge to Hope. You know, they put me with a counselor and they let me be angry and they let me bargain and they let me accept and all those little things you go through when you're grieving. And it was a little more gentle than the first time. And the interesting thing is I didn't drink through it, you know. But I was still angry, and I'm not working nothing but the first step at this point in time, and I have no relief, none. And so I'm just a butthole, you know, and I'm walking around Bridge of Hope just driving everybody crazy. And so about 6 weeks after my daughter died, I get called to the office, and I was lucky enough to have the director as my sponsor. I didn't get to pick my sponsor for some strange reason. They're like, no, you get her. So, you know, this lady was a tough cookie. And she was raw and uncut. And she didn't sugarcoat anything. That was exactly what I needed. Even though I didn't know it then. So I remember getting in trouble because of my attitude. Right? And so I said, I'm sorry, Miss You-Know-Who. I just... You know, my kid just died. I'm sorry, I'm not doing jumping jacks in your front yard. And she looked me dead in my eyeballs and said, so what? Now what? So all I got to say is I got kicked out that day. But today, I get it. You know, she knew I was holding on for dear life for a reason to drink. And me being a butthole to everybody wasn't going to bring my daughter back. And it wasn't going to help me get sober. You know, she knew that. I didn't know that. So I know it now. So now I'm kind of like the so what, now what sponsor. And so fast forward, I get kicked out of Bridge to Hope. And, you know, I didn't drink and I didn't drug. And I'm the victim. You know, don't they know how bad it is for me? How dare you? And then my ego kicked in. And I'm going to tell you, I'm going to stay sober in spite of them. Still didn't like AA. Still wasn't real interested in stopping forever. I thought that maybe we could just learn how to drink a couple of cocktails at night, right? So y'all know how that goes. I ended up back in prison, you know. And it wasn't for, it was for violation of my parole, because I got in a fight and really got beat up by my daughter's dad. And see, that was another part I left out. Like, he was not my husband. My daughter was the daughter of the dope dealer. So, you know, now I also know God did for me what I couldn't do for myself, because I would not be sober if I was linked to him. You know, I know that today. So at the end of the day, you know, I get kicked out. I'm the victim. I have to go back to prison, blah, blah, blah. And I sat and I really could not believe I was locked back up sober. Well, dry. I was dry. I'm not so sure I was sober, but. And it was like I knew that I had to change. It wasn't just the drugs and alcohol. It was me, you know. So here I am on my way back to prison again. You know, and this is 2004. And I wrote the parole board a letter. And I don't know how, you know, by the grace of something bigger than me, I don't have a drug charge. But you typically have to get in the program that I begged the parole board to give me. It's called Correctional Recovery Academy. And it was at Pulaski State Prison. And it was 9 months intense recovery. And you normally had to have a drug charge to get in this program. I wrote them a letter and begged them. I just was sick and tired of going to prison. Not drinking, but I was sick and tired of going to prison. So whatever. I'm ready to do something different. You know, when I got to you know, Diagnostic Metro and got my schedule, I found out I was going to that program. And I didn't care about anything after that. My kid was home. You know, all I wanted was to try, just try. Maybe you people were onto something. So here we are, and I'm in prison. I'm going to tell you, man, I was on fire. I loved being in that program. It was the first time I had hope. And I worked these doggone steps as hard as I could. And then we're at this point where I did a 33-page fourth step. Not because I was telling the story of my, it was simple. Few words, I'm telling you, I hated everything. I had a resentment to everything. You know, I was a big old fat victim. And so now I have to tell this to somebody. Well, I'm in prison and I'm not telling these ladies nothing, okay? And I was at a place where who do I tell my fifth step to? It's not like you have sponsors in there. You know, you get a sponsor for 5 minutes a week. All right? So, I figured maybe the prison psychiatrist, who knew me well, maybe, just maybe, he would be a good, because the big book says, maybe a psychiatrist, maybe a friend, maybe this person, maybe. So it was worth trying. So I went up to him. We all called him Bruce. Hey, Bruce, I need to talk to you. He's like, oh, no. I said, no, this is different. And I said, hey, do you know anything about the 12 steps? And he looked at me like I had three eyeballs. And he said, yeah. I said, well, I want to do my fifth step with you. And he said, I'd be honored. And the big book says if you explain to them why you're doing this, he will be honored. And that was my first confirmation. You know, I wasn't into y'all's God yet, but that was my first bigger than me confirmation. The simple word, honored. And so we go through, and I'm spilling out my guts to this guy doing my fifth step, you know. Hadn't even done step two, but I told him I did. Yes, I believe. Okay? I went to do my fifth step with this guy, and about 2 hours into it, he called his wife and told his wife he's going to be late for dinner. That meant the world to me. It ended up taking 4 hours for us to get through that. I got honest with him about how many times I've lied to him over the years. And I got to tell you, we had pavilion call after that 4 hours. And I remember just going out and just swinging around. And I was with a friend of mine. I said, I am free. And she said, B, you're locked up in prison. I said, no, I'm free. I'm free. I knew right then and there that Sandy was returning. I knew it. I thought I did step two until I did my fifth step. And I knew I was going to try everything I could, turn my will over, and keep going with them steps. So, you know, there's not a lot of amends you can make in prison. They've heard all that crap. You know, I've said all the great stuff, and I've been locked up enough times where it's in one ear and out the other. So I did have to wait till I got out and make living amends. I had to. They didn't want to hear none of my crap. You know, and it took a year after year after year. I was released January 9th, 2006. I've not been back. I'm going to tell you, on that day when I got released, the day before I got released, I remember my counselor saying to me, she said, the biggest decision you're going to make in your life up to this point is whether or not you go to an AA meeting when you get out of here. And so you're like, yeah, you know, okay. And on that, you know, give you a little martyr token and send you on your way. And I remember asking that martyr guy, I said, hey, do you know where AA meeting is? You know, I was all shy. I don't want y'all to know I'm a drunk. And he told me, go to, you know, Five Points and get on the northbound, go to Dunwoody and get on 87 and tell me you want to go to 8111. I said, does he going to know what that is? Because I certainly didn't know what it was. And he said, yeah, he's going to know what it is. And so I was like, all right. So I do what he tells me to do. And you know, I'm excited, man. I'm 2 years sober by this point. And I really worked steps as hard as I could. And I was on fire. And I love this big book. And I wanted to go brag. That's exactly what I wanted to do. I wanted to go to real Amy and brag to y'all how good I had done in prison. So anyways, we're driving, riding. And bus stop comes. And he pulls right in front of 8111 and gets on the intercom. Says,
8111.
And I was appalled. I was like, oh my God. Now I guarantee you they all knew I just got out of prison because all my belongings was in a clear plastic bag. Nobody does that unless they're getting out of jail. But God forbid they know I'm an alcoholic. So I go in, and you know, there was a meeting called Sober Sisters. They're no longer there, but they were there then, and they met at 10 o'clock. I was released at 8. 2 hours after I got released, I was in the AA meeting. And I'm going to tell you, I got my hand up. I'm ready to tell y'all how sober I am. And I did. And I was excited, and I had hope. And there was a lady in the other corner, and she had her hand up after me, and she was in tears. This lady had known me for 5 years in Cobb County Jail. She took AA in there. In and out, she saw me, in and out. And I would go to AA just to get out of the dorm. I didn't give a rat's behind about the steps. And she would see me, and she'd be like, Lily, what are you doing back? I'm like, oh, I just missed you, you know, I just blow her off, you know. That lady was over there. And she said, that's why I do what I do. She was in tears. And she'd been doing it for 5 years, and I was the first person that she had seen from inside out. After 5 years of being of service in corrections. So anyway, she became my sponsor. And that was pretty cool, you know, because I didn't have, you know, that weird thing of asking somebody, they'll be your sponsor, you know. It's like asking somebody on a first date. You're just afraid of rejection. She already knew about me. I didn't want the rest of 8111 that I was a convict, you know. But she knew. She wasn't scared of me, and that was all great. And then Sober Sisters decides to move to Roswell. And she went with them. And now here I am, and I don't have a sponsor. And now here I am, really not spiritually fit, okay? little institutionalization and stuff like that. And I started going to a 6:15 a.m. meeting because I had to do community service because I cussed out a police officer. Sober. Don't do that. There's still consequences. So by doing community service, I found the 6:15 meeting. I really liked it, but none of the ladies would sponsor me. And I asked 12 ladies in a row to sponsor me, and 12 ladies in a row told me no. And I remember the last lady. I mean, she was board of directors and AA cheerleader, and she worked for General Service. I used to. She's no longer does. And I just knew she was going to be my sponsor because she's like real AA. Not only did she tell me no, but she highly suggested I didn't ask her sponsor either. And I remember in the lobby saying, what the F is wrong with me? And this lady right here, I love her. She said, you're a B and people are scared of you. And that was just hard to hear because AA people petrified me. I don't know how to hang around sober people. What do you mean you're scared of me? You guys scare me. And so, but she was the only one that told me the truth. You know, I needed somebody to say exactly what I heard so it could give me something to work on, you know. And so, you know, I haven't been sober the whole time I've been out. I relapsed 7 years ago. And I got to tell you, this isn't always popular. It was the best thing that ever happened to me. It's the best thing that happened to me because it reminded me that desperation can never leave me. I'm one drink away from being exactly where I was 13 years ago. So, you know, I don't take for granted that I have a daily reprieve anymore, you know. So now, you know, we've been out a few years, blah, blah, blah. You know, I busted my butt to get my boys back. I left the part out that I'll brief you right quick is one of my six sons I gave up for adoption. Well, he got stolen from me when I was in prison by my sister, who is a police officer. And we showed up in court, and I had blues that said state prisoner on them, and she had blues that said police officer. So she won that case. She got to adopt my kid. I got him back. I got him back. So Alcoholics Anonymous, dude, there's no limit to what the possibilities are. So, you know, the way my life looks now, you know, I do work for 8111. That's the weirdest thing ever. They trust me. They handed me keys. It's like, that's really weird. Been completely transparent with them. They've saved my life. I married my A sweetheart. You know, he is 18 years sober and is the epitome of recovery. And it's just, matter of fact, less than a year ago, so I'm kind of still newlywed. And that's pretty spectacular. I am corrections outreach for District 13 because my life was saved in prison by you guys. And I'm so very grateful. My life is neat. I don't have a bunch of fancy words for you guys. My life is neat. My life rocks. And, you know, I try to give back MGSR for my home group. I don't like it. You know, ego will get you into service and humility will keep you in it. And that's where I am with that. But I can't ever thank Alcoholics Anonymous enough for what I've done. You know, I'm re-entered, and that's a big thing for me. I advocate downtown. I go downtown with my pink ponytail and scream, "Recovery is real!" And I scream that, you know, re-entry and criminal reform is real also. I do not break the law today because I incorporate principles in my life. No other reason than that, you know. I do not get angry as much as I get mad all the time. I am a brat. But I don't get angry. You know, the resentments, they're fleeting. Oh, when they come, they go. It's not worth it to me anymore. I work with other alcoholics. They are the bright spot of my life. It's the only time I'm not selfish. I'm still extremely selfish and self-centered. But when I'm doing service work, I can get out of that. You know, you guys have given me a way out of that. And that's amazing. And, you know, I've actually got this is non-AA, but it's the possibilities. I got a full scholarship to legislative training just to learn that I could run and hold office. Now, I don't want to. I hate politics. It's driving me nuts. But the fact that somebody heard me and they say, "Hey, come with us. We're going to teach you how to speak properly." You know, that's what Alcoholics Anonymous does for me. My life is so neat. I just linked up with the National Incarceration Association so we could figure out how to help get AA as part of reentry, or at least 12 steps. That's where we have to start for right now. But, you know, I'm very active in, criminal reform and recovery because I just don't break the law anymore. I don't believe the lies anymore. I'm not the victim anymore, and I'm certainly not entitled anymore. And when all that happened, I could start living like a normal human being. So with that, I'm going to read one more thing out of this big book. This is my second step. This is my second step. This is my mugshot. I never want to forget it. I never want to forget all my charges, my aliases. I never want to forget it. That's insanity. And I'm not insane today. I'm one drink away from insanity. So anyways, the only real freedom a human being can ever know is doing what you ought to do because you want to do it. This great experience that released me from the bondage of hatred or a place that would love is really just another affirmation of the truth I know. I get everything I need in Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything I need, I get. And when I get what I need, I invariably find that it was just what I wanted all the time. You guys have been awesome.
Wow. Thank you very much for that story. That was really powerful, Libby. That's like having somebody tell you the truth, like a big bitch slap, isn't it? But we need that, and so it'll keep us, or get sober if we hear it, like you just said. So thank you for that. I've asked Tinsley to give out the tips.
My name is Tinsley. I'm an alcoholic.
Tinsley.
And what a great story. Thank you for coming to NAB and telling us that story. I'll remember that forever. Here at this meeting, we have a chip system to mark our time away from our last drink. If you'd like to try this way of life one day at a time, we offer a white chip. But I'd like to pick up a white chip. Anybody else for a white chip? Anybody else want to reconsider on a white chip? We have a silver chip for 30 days. Anybody got 30 days? A red chip for 90 days? Yeah. Anybody else got 90 days? How about 6 months for a yellow chip? Anybody got 6 months? Green chip for 9 months? Blue chip for 1 year or multiples. Anybody celebrating a birthday? Anybody want to reconsider on a white chip? Got a big hand for the chips you hold.
First I slip and then I crib to a hope-filled dream. You rescue me. And finally, waking there I see. I look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promises are. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, stride for stride, we walk eternally. Looking to love's window for a heart that beats for me. Takes me where the promises are real. Something that set me free. And I'd arrive to a world in harmony. See love as a vision that one day would appear. Take me where the promises are.